on RN, The Philosopher's Zone. Joe Gelonesi with you. Great to have your company again. Today, the freedom to be free.
People say, look, insofar as you're actually not interfered with, you're perfectly free. Whereas on the older way of thinking, no, you're not free if someone else has a power of interfering with you. And freedom turns on whose will is in control. And if somebody else's will is in control, even though that person lets you act as you wish, that means they're still the boss.
So, how free do you feel from the will and whim of your fellow humans? Do you pass the eyeball test to look others straight in the eye without deference? Philip Pettit would wish it so, though in his eyes, freedom isn't what it used to be. There is a more robust version hailing from the Roman Republic, and it might serve us well to rediscover it. Philip Pettit is Professor of Politics at Princeton and of Philosophy at ANU, and he'll address freedom at a very special public lecture. Philip Pettit, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. It's terrific going to be giving the Alan Saunders Memorial Lecture this year. Can I ask you, you say that we live in times more uncertain than our species has ever faced, certainly in the 12,000 years since we've tilled the plains. What does that mean?
Well, it sounds rather deeper, really, than I'm capable of being. I mean, I'm drawing on what we all learn from what's happening from science and so on. What I mean simply is that our climate is obviously transforming at an enormous rate. Our population is growing at an extraordinary rate. We have institutions, you know, that have grown up over a long time, like the institution of the state and so on. It's not absolutely clear how these things will survive together. It's a very challenging future that we face. I didn't mean to be profound about it in any original philosophical way, but just to, you know, report basically what should be common sense and common knowledge amongst us.
And in relation to that, you say that we should try to find a new GPS, a new moral compass for one that perhaps is broken or perhaps doesn't work anymore. What has happened in that regard? Why do we need a new way of being able to settle disputes, as it were?
My aim is to try to identify a goal that, it seems to me, from different corners of politics, people can all agree is indeed an important goal, and that it can provide a touchstone, you know, benchmark for where we ought to be going.
That thing that we're searching for, you call freedom, and a particular kind of freedom. Perhaps a bit of ancient history 101 here. You take it back to the Roman Republic as a way of tracing its beginnings. Tell me about the notion of freedom in the Roman Republic.
My argument certainly traces the notion back to the Roman Republic and possibly earlier, but in the Roman Republic it became particularly prominent. The idea of the Republican picture of government emerges in Rome most clearly probably about 100 years before the fall of the Republic. It's actually partly the work of a Greek slave called Polybius, who was held in Rome for a period and lived with a major Roman family as a hostage, essentially. And then when freed, he remained in Rome for much of his life, and he wrote a history of Rome, which basically emphasized these features of the Roman dispensation, that one, freedom was the crucial value for everybody who was a citizen. Of course, in Rome, the citizens were a minority, not as they ought to be, as we would say, all of us, an inclusive group. They're male, of course, but they actually included a lot of unpropertied males, so it was fairly expansive. Anyhow, the idea was that freedom is the important sort of value that each should enjoy. And the rule of law under which people can gain that sort of freedom is what he called a mixed constitution, meaning you had different centers of power. No one person, no one body held all the power. So even amongst the government of the time, you always had two consuls, as we know. You had two or three or four or five of almost every officer in the state. And you got a number of different bodies that actually made the laws. So he thought those were the two core elements. You had the ideal of freedom and an institution of a mixed constitution. A mixed constitution that allowed the people have a real role in controlling government. Now, that was the Republican package. When the Republic fell and we had 500 years of empire, the interesting thing is that many of the Republican ideas remained formally part of the Roman tradition, so that near the end of the Roman Empire, near the end of, you know, the glory of Rome, which is about 550 AD, Justinian, who's the remaining emperor, he's now based in Constantinople, it's the Eastern Roman Empire. He has all of the laws of Rome codified and a number of books that summarize the laws of Rome, but they're actually mainly Republican-type laws. So it survives in that way. Now, what happens after is that in the medieval Italian city-states like Florence and Venice and so on that appear in the late Middle Ages, they see themselves and their citizens as very different from, for example, the subjects of the Pope in Rome, where you have the Papal States, or the subjects in France or in Spain or even in England of basically a powerful monarch. They see themselves as having a sort of independence, a freedom, and they begin to reconceptualize, to rethink their relationship to their state, like Venice or Florence. And you've got to remember, these small city-states were among the richest states in the whole of Europe at the time, though they were small. They begin to rethink themselves in the old Roman terminology. So they revivify the older Republican set of ideas, Roman Republican set of ideas. Those ideas then pass into England, for example, in the 17th century. They also have a role in Poland and in the Dutch Republic, for example. But England of the 17th century, when you get the Republic declared under Cromwell, when the king is actually executed, and then you get the second phase, so to speak, in England after 1688, when there's a king, all right, William, but now appointed on the terms that Parliament establishes. In this tradition, they take over those Roman Renaissance ideas.
So I don't miss this. The key to this Republican model is the non-domination aspect of freedom, in that you are free from anyone else's domination of any sort. I think if you mentioned that to people now, most people would say to you, well, I'm pretty free of most other people. I mean, no one, I'm not a slave, I'm not a chattel, I'm not a good. I'm able to carry out my life in the way I wish. What is it about non-domination in particular that's makes it an important aspect of this?
Perhaps I can give a more concrete example of that away from history. I use in the Just Freedom book probably overuse the example of, from Ibsen's play, A Doll's House. You get the husband is Torvald, the wife is Nora. Torvald completely dotes on Nora. He gives her absolutely everything she wants, except for macaroons, which she gets in here because she hides them in her skirts. If you remember the beginning of the play. Now, Nora is absolutely not interfered with in a whole range of, any range of choice that might have been reasonable for a 19th century person, certainly a woman. She's completely uninterfered with. Torvald, on the other hand, holds all the cards in his hand because he's got all the legal power, the financial power, the cultural power. He can dictate who she associates with, where she goes, whether she goes out of doors, how she dresses, what she eats.
Are you quite sure you didn't get up to anything in town today?
No, Torvald, whatever do you mean?
You didn't, for instance, find yourself visiting the confectioner's?
No, really, I promise you, Torvald.
Not even a little bag of macaroons?
No, really, Torvald, nothing. You know I wouldn't dream of doing anything you disapproved of.
Of course not. And anyway, you did promise, didn't you?
He's got lordship, as it were, over everything. Now, the question is, do we think of Nora as being free? Well, she's got full non-interference. Torvald is not actually bothering her in any way. He's giving her carte blanche, as we say. He's giving her free rein, you might put it. But actually, most would say she's not free. And that actually picks up this Republican way of thinking. In Latin, they used to say, in the power of a master, in potestate domini. She lives in the power of a master, and even though he's a very kindly master, the fact that he's a master means she's not free. Does she act according to her own will? Well, yes, she does. But she acts according to her own will because that happens to accord with Torvald's will. It's ultimately his will that's in control. And freedom turns on whose will is in control. Is it your will or is it somebody else's will? And if somebody else's will is in control, even though that will, that person, lets you act as you wish, that means they're still the boss. That's the core sort of idea.
Spend swift, Torvald, I know. But if we do what I suggest, then I can buy myself something I really want. Doesn't that sound reasonable?
Oh, of course it sounds reasonable, but I know, and you know, that you'll simply spend it on housekeeping and all sorts of useless things.
It's not fair. How can you say that? I save as much as I can.
Of course, as much as you can. But as much as you can comes to nothing.
So just back to the history then for a moment. The weaker notion of freedom, or at least freedom as non-interference, that's the one that won out, even though there were some attempts at reviving the Republican model, the Roman Republican model, in some of the examples that you gave. Why was that the case? I mean, this, I imagine we now would be talking about the time of the rise of liberalism, classical liberalism, and then modern liberalism. Why did one give over to the other?
Well, it's a fascinating history as I read it. Two things worth noting. One is that the notion actually first appears in what we think of as its modern form among the defenders of the British against the Americans. They all say the problem is that Britain is maintaining the position of a master in the lives of the Americans. On the other hand, those who defend the British, what they say, there's a very famous, well, a very influential text published in 1776 in London by someone called John Lind, and what he maintains is the following. He says, look, what are the Americans complaining of? He says, the law, as it's imposed in Britain, of course it intrudes on our choices, and it intrudes on the choices of those in America. So what's the big difference? If you think of freedom as just the absence of constraint or restraint, then the Americans are no less free than the British. So that's the first time you get a very clear appeal to the notion of freedom as non-interference. Mm. I mean, there had been some earlier foreshadowing of that in the work of someone called Thomas Hobbes in the 17th century, but this is really where it comes to the fore in public life. Now, very soon after that, 25, 30 years after that, in the very early 1800s, you get the same notion of freedom as non-interference being used to justify the new, very changing social world as you get growing industrialization, massive movements of people from the country where there were traditional rights and so on that you had as a tenant farmer or even as a serf, into the cities where you had no traditional sort of roles, no traditional restrictions, no traditional rights. You basically, if you were a poor person, you looked for work and you negotiated a contract that did the best that you could for yourself. But it was often, of course, very hard on you. Now, in this world, the notion of freedom of the older sort, of not having a master in your life, that becomes irrelevant in a way, as a lot of these people see it. And they want to say about this world that it's a world in which everyone is free because the terms on which you relate to other people are decided freely in contract. So at that point, they again use the notion of freedom as non-interference, and that becomes a second, so to speak, location where the idea takes off. Mm. By about 40 years later, I'd say 30 to 40 years later, it's become the common way of thinking about freedom.
Mm. It's interesting, some big players, and you mentioned Thomas Hobbes there, but there would have been others, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Jeremy Bentham, some other bigger players had a chance, I guess, to perhaps bat for the Republican team, but in fact took the other direction towards non-interference. Hobbes obviously felt it would be a war of all against all, I gather, if we had this kind of mixed constitution. Bentham, I think, for other reasons, perhaps, of not wanting to alter arrangements in the private sphere, perhaps, between husband and wife or male and female. I'm not sure. Please fill me in on that. And Rousseau could have also have gone down that track, but didn't in the social contract. Why was that the case?
Well, I think I would think of Rousseau as he remains on the Republican side and he's thinking about freedom. He thinks very much that freedom does indeed require not having a boss, not having a master in your life, not being subject to somebody else's thumb, even someone who's very nice to you. He's quite clear about that. Where Rousseau differs from the older tradition is he rejects the notion of the mixed constitution and the notion that the system of law that would give you this empowerment and these rights against others, whereby you would not be subject to the will of any other. The mixed constitution suggested you could only have that system of law if it were subject, there are many centers of power and they're all subject to popular sort of pressure. Rousseau opted instead for the notion that you could have a single assembly of all the citizens, which by voting would establish the law. So that's where he breaks. Bentham is the really interesting person, because in a way, Bentham is the founder of the new way of thinking that emerges in the 19th century and ultimately becomes known as liberalism. Bentham is the one who really takes up this new notion of freedom. He thinks it's too metaphorical, it's too airy, it's too rhetorical. And he wants he's basically thinking about reforming the law. He wants a more exact enlightenment sort of notion that you can measure and add up. He doesn't actually give up on some of the values associated with freedom as non-domination. He calls them by the different name of security. So he says, apart from freedom, meaning non-interference, we should insist on the importance of people enjoying security. But of course, that gets forgotten in the development. Freedom remains, but it's now freedom as rethought in this new image of non-interference rather than non-domination.
Political philosopher Philip Pettit on how to be truly free. And he's on the Philosopher's Zone here on RN.
So where are we now with this idea of domination? Again, I say if you look around, if you were to ask people, people wouldn't say that they feel that they need to tug the forelock, or they can look someone else squarely in the eye, look you in the eye and say, you know, I'm proud to be a fellow human being on this planet. Where is that domination now, and why is there such a need for a reinterpretation of the Roman Republican version of it?
Well, I think there are many different ways of looking at it, but to take just a few contexts, I mean, one is the context of the workplace. In Australia, things are much better than they are elsewhere. But for example, even in the United States, in most situations, an employer, an owner can dismiss someone without cause, without having to face any, so to speak, constraint in doing so. Now, if you, as an employee in a time of high unemployment, are in a situation where you can be dismissed at will by an employer, that means you basically hang on the goodwill of the employer. So I would say in a relationship like that, that you are in a situation where you have to hang on the grace and favor of another. You can't look them in the eye without reason for fear or deference, which is the old sort of Republican phrase. You really are in the position of a supplicant. And even if that employer is very nice to you, doesn't interfere with you, doesn't throw his or her weight around, for example, it's still the case that you're in that relationship of subjection to them. Now, I think that historically, and this is something I fear we're forgetting, historically, whatever ills, other ills they may be responsible for, unions were extremely important in enabling working people to regain, so to speak, the capacity to look their employer in the eye because they had this power behind them. Otherwise, you get a power of big business and you get absolutely no countervailing power to, as it were, put steel in the back of a working person. So that's one context. But of course, much more generally, the position of people who are in the position of immigrants, for example, or an ethnic minority or a religious minority, the relationship between individuals and corporations, for example, in public life and so on, the relationship between governments and corporations. I think in many of these contexts, you find a relationship of domination where you get a power on the one side, which may not necessarily actively interfere, but it means that the other side have got to always be conscious, so to speak, of that power and keep them sweet. So I think there are a whole range of contexts, both in personal life and in political life.
Surely one of the objections is that it in fact calls for fairly active interference in people's lives. I'm sure you've tackled this argument, but I wonder, is that live argument between negative freedom and positive freedom, is that in there somewhere?
I'm not sure I like the negative-positive characterization, to be absolutely honest, but taking it aboard for the moment, I guess you would think of the notion of freedom as non-domination as being more towards the positive end. But let's go back to basics, so to speak. If you think of freedom as non-interference, then your notion is going to be, look, the law always interferes with people, so we should have as little law as possible, just have the minimum law needed for, let's suppose, law and order. And then after that, you just let things rip, you know, let people deal with one another in the market, let inequalities emerge, whatever way you like. People insist, though, that all relations are contractual, and you get a sort of totally marketed type society, a neoliberal sort of vision. Now, in that neoliberal vision, as we know, there are going to be huge differences of resources, differences of influence, differences of power. There are going to be huge dependencies between different groups of people, between individuals. Now, if you think of freedom as just no one's getting in the way, no one's actually, you know, blocking you from doing things or whatever, you might say that non-interference as a whole is aggregatively at its zenith, so to speak, at its height in that particular arrangement. But now if you think about freedom as being a situation where you can look others in the eye without reason for fear or deference, you go back to the Neo-Roman sort of republican notion. And it seems to me, if you think about Nora and Thorvald, that that's a very gripping sort of ideal. You're not free unless you can look others in the eye without fear or deference, or you're protected by a system of law in which you share equally with others in controlling, right? I suppose at this point I want to thump the table and say that, you know, really, if you're thinking, you've got a big choice. One is, do you think that it should be everyone for themselves, you know, a laissez-faire, let it rip? If you think it should be that sort of world and that's what freedom means, then what you're looking for is a free-for-all society. You know, it really is a free-for-all. You know, it's going to be pretty chaotic, and there's going to be huge inequalities, and there's going to be a lot of dependency and a lot of unfreedom in this other alternative, longer traditional way of thinking, the republican way of thinking. But then if you move over to that way of thinking and recognize the freedom requires that you're not at the beck and call of another, that you're not hanging on their goodwill, then you have to have a legally established framework that gives people their own areas of sovereign choice under a law that they all share in controlling. That society, of course, is wholly consistent with there being a market. I'm not for any moment now moving away from a market-based society. I think that in those areas, that's the only way we know of inducing prosperity. It's completely consistent with that. But it says that the state and the market are equally essential. Law and the market are equally, they're two sides of one coin in establishing a society that really makes freedom its be-all and end-all.
It's a nice idea, but does it work in practice? Well, President Zapatero of Spain tried it and asked Philip Pettit to sit in judgment. So how did the president go?
How did he go? Well, the media, they insisted on asking me the score and so on. I actually think he did extremely well in that first term in government. I mean, he introduced gay marriage, one of the first legislatures in the world to pass it, with 65% popular support, on the grounds he actually used in Parliament that otherwise people couldn't pass the eyeball test, as I call it. He said, how can you look someone who's homosexual in the eye and say, we deny you the right for your relationship to be recognized in the same civic, legal way that our relationships, we who are heterosexual, are recognized. He used that. He introduced various measures to increase the equality and participation of women in public life and their protection in private life. He regularized the position of, I think, 750,000 illegal immigrants with, on the whole, broad acceptance in Spanish public life. Of course, in fairness, that was a period of, it seemed, relative affluence. We didn't know that the GFC was just around the corner. He didn't handle the crisis particularly well, but then who did? And it hit Spain particularly badly because of conditions in the European Union and the fact that you had enormous credit available to Spain, a building spree, house prices absolutely inflating. And of course, then once the GFC came, that undermined all of that. He had been aware, actually, of those problems, and they had been written about, and I wrote about them, actually, in my report, too, as ones that the government was taking account of, it seemed. But, of course, none of us knew what was going to happen, the disaster that was about to fall upon us.
Philip Pettit, thank you for your time. I do wish you the best with the lecture, and it's good to see you in Australia.
Thank you very much.
Philip Pettit is Professor of Politics at Princeton and Professor of Philosophy at ANU, and he's giving this year's Alan Saunders Memorial Lecture in Canberra in July on this topic of the Republican model of freedom. If you want to come along, and you are most welcome, keep an eye on our webpage for details. Head for RN and find the Philosopher's Zone on the drop-down menu. On behalf of the team, Joe Wallace and Diane Dean, I'm Joe Gelonesi. More philosophy next week in The Zone. Hope to see you then.
20 years after the first multiracial elections, South Africans go to the polls again. And while the ANC is sure to win, it's a very different political landscape.
In scenes reminiscent of the apartheid era, police have opened fire on striking workers at a plant.
We've seen the largest trade union in South Africa saying that it will no longer support the ANC in elections, and this is a big moment.
South African democracy. You can download or stream this revision from the RN website.